Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Lamed Amud Aleph. The Gemara says, Shotcha l'tzorcha, aval lo l'chvodo. That you're allowed to put out bigadim or items to take care of them for the benefit of the Aveda, but not for your own benefit. So you have guests coming over, and you want to display an item, a tapestry, something that is expensive and beautiful looking. You're not allowed to use the Aveda in that context to benefit yourself. You can only take it out when it's necessary for it to be aerated, for it to be shaken out. So you buy the tzorcho u l'tzorcha mai. What happens if there's overlapping interests over here, which is that the item needs to be aired out, but it also happens to be that you're having guests over at that time. Tashma, our Mishnah, shotcha l'tzorcha, l'tzorcha in, ha l'tzorcha u l'tzorcha lo. You even die for our Mishnah that you're allowed to shake it out, bring it out for its own benefit. But that means that if it was for your benefit and the benefit of the item, you would not be ema seifa. But you could just make the opposite deal from the seifa, which is avolo lichvodo, not for your own benefit. Lichvodo hudulo. That's only when it's brought out for your own benefit that you're not allowed to do it. Halat l'tzorcha l'tzorcho. It's for the benefit of the avida and your benefit. Shapir dami, that would have been fine. Elamiha lekala mashamimina. From the Mishnah, you can't be midayek, because the Mishnah leaves this in-between case open. And the Mishnah has a case where it's for the benefit of the item. Yes, that's permitted. And it's your benefit that's not permitted. The in-between case, you can't tell in the Mishnah which way the Mishnah leans because it doesn't address that case. So Tashma, lo yishtachena, lo al gabei mita, v'lo gabei magod. You should not stretch it out over a bed, not on top of a smaller bed of some sort, or a peg or a frame for the clothing, or like a clothes rack of some sort that you lay out the clothes to dry on. Litzorcho, for his own benefit. Ava yishtachen al gabi mita, v'avogei magod litzorcha. You can do that for its benefit. Nizdamnu l'orchim, if guests show up, lo yishtachena. Lo al gabi mita, v'lo gabi magod. You can't put it out, not on a bed, not on a stool. Ben litzorcho, ben litzorcha. Whether it's for your benefit or for the benefit of the item. This braita would seem to address it head on, which is that when it comes to joint benefit, meaning the benefit of the item as well as your benefit, that we would not permit, because here when the guests show up, we force you to fold it up or put it away. Kama says, shiny hotam. It's different over there. Demikla kolila. Because he is burning it up. It's as if he's setting fire to it. Imishum eina, imishum ganve. Because of the problem either of ayin hara, or because of the problem of theft. Which is that when the guests come, he is putting this object at risk for one of two reasons. Either because the guests are going to look at it and give an ayin hara because they're jealous or whatever bad or ill will they have about him owning this item. Or because the guests will then plot to steal it because they see it and they desire it. So because of one of those reasons, we say if you put it out there, it's as if you're destroying it. So the reason there is not because it's tzorcho and tzorcha, that's the main issue. The biggest problem is that in doing it, the tzorcha, and then the tzorcho for your own benefit, you're also putting it in harm's way. And so because of that, we won't permit it. But that doesn't mean in a normal instance, we wouldn't allow you to do it. So tashma, hichnisa l'ravka v'dasha k'sheira. So here, it's a question about what this is speaking about. Rashi claims it's speaking about an egla rufa. By the Tosafot say it's a tosefta that's speaking about a para aduma. The reason it may not matter is because, as Tosafot discusses over here, and many Rishonim also discuss, that there is this equation of equivalence between the dinim of egla rufa and para aduma. Both of them have a requirement that you do not work with them. Both of them have a requirement that you do not put an ol on them, that you not put a yoke on them. There is a gzereshova learnt by some in the Gemara. There's some Tanaim that believe that there's a gzereshova between them of ol. Then once you do that, then it's clear that whatever rule applies to one applies to the other. But what Tosafot points out is even without that gzereshova, because of the fact that they both have restriction against avodah and ol, the two of them have this parallel nature in their isur. So whatever you know about one, we're going to apply to the other even without that gzeirah shavah. So that's why, again, Rashi and Tosafot are disagreeing about exactly what it's speaking about. But in the end, it may not matter because it might applies to both. Both an Egla Rufa and a Paraduma, which is a restriction against the animal doing any work. So Rashi claims over here, Ichnisla the Ravka is Middabakim Shlosh Behemot or Arba B'tzavrein. Sounds like a yoke that you place across them. Somewhat difficult because of the fact that there is a restriction of an O, Lo'aleo O. Rashi seems to indicate that they move together or it's some sort of system that brings them parallel. And then Vedasha, and then they thresh. So here his intent is not for them to thresh, just simply to have it work together or walk together with the other animals. And then they end up threshing, not because he wants them to, not because he encouraged them to. Others suggest over here that the Ravka, which would make more sense, is into its corral. He put it into its corral, and it ends up threshing whatever was in the corral, again, unintentionally, Ksheira. It remains kasher because you didn't intend for the work here. You're not trying to guide the animal to do work. Therefore, it's kshera. B'shvil shetinoket tidosh psula. On the other hand, if it is going in there in order to both, as Rashi says over here, he wants it to nurse as well as to thresh, then it is psula because you have intent for it to provide or do something. Because of the intent over here, it makes it into something that is problematic because you want it to do the work or you want it while it's nursing to also be dash, to thresh at the same time. Mara says, that's a case, the litzorcho ulitzorchahu. Over there where he puts it in, both to nurse and to thresh, it's both to his benefit and to the benefit of the animal. Viktani psula. And you see that that deems it to be pasul, or ruins its ability to be used anymore for paraduma or negla rufa, even though he's doing it jointly, both for his own benefit as well as the benefit of the animal. The animal's nursing is for its own benefit, the threshing is for his benefit. So despite the fact that you have both of those interests involved, we still say psula. When it says shani hatam, that's different, damakra. The pasuk says, asher lo ubad ba, that no work was done with it, mikol makom. Doesn't matter what type of work or any work or how intentional the work is, it's poselet. Meaning that even though there's a interest for the animal here, still your interest in the work already makes it problematic. Where it says, Ihochi, if you're going to say that, afilu reish nami. What about the first half of the Tosefta that we just quoted? That should also be problematic. How come when he puts it into Ravka and it's dash, even you though you didn't intend for that, we just said unintentional work is enough to deem it pasul. Aludamia, that's not similar. Elalaha, that's like this case. That's not. We have a Mishnah in Parah. Here it's clearly talking about a Parah Duma. Shachan alea of Ksheira. If a bird rests on the back of the animal, then it is Ksheira. That's not considered it carrying a load. It's not considered that it's working. Ala alea zachar. On the other hand, if it's mounted by a male, psula. Then it is pasul. My time. Huh? What's the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa? What the Gemara's claim is that the case of putting it into the corral and having it thresh unintentionally is equivalent to a bird landing on the back of the animal. But even there, the paraduma here distinguishes between the case of the bird landing on the back and a male mounting it. So kidra papa, damra papa, this is similar to what we saw with regards to hechsher the kabul tuma. That the Torah uses the passive form of the verb, yet it writes it in the active form of the verb. We saw over there, ki yutan, which is to passively have water or liquids come upon the item, but it's spelled ki itain, which is intentional action of putting a liquid on the item. Similarly over here, you have the word ubad and avad, which is ikitiv, ubad, vikarin, and ubad. If it was the passive form of the verb, it was written that way and read that way, havamina afilu memela, then it wouldn't matter. No matter what type of work it was doing, quote unquote, that would be poselet, even if a bird landed on the back, even if you put it into the corral and ended up threshing. Viktiv avad, viktrin and avad, if you use the active form of the verb, both written and that's the way that it is pronounced, havamina ad avad ba, until you actively engage the animal in work. Even now, when it's written, it just has ayin vet dalid, which would be the active form of the verb avad, the karina and ubad, but the pronunciation or the kri that we have is that it's ubad, that work was done with it. Binan, ubad, dumya da'avad. We need the passive form of the verb similar to the active form of the verb. Ma'avad de'nechale, just like by the active form of the verb, obviously you want it done because you are engaging the animal in this avoda. Af ubad de'nechale. So too, when it's in the passive form, it also has to be with your approval or something that you want to happen. So over here, when the bird lands on the back of the animal, you have no vested interest in the bird landing on the back of the animal, and therefore, it's not considered to be work. Even though it says ubad, and it's doing something b'me'ilah passively, which is what the verb indicates, but because it's spelt avad, we need also the other aspect of it is, which is you want this to happen, that you are happy with whatever is there. So therefore, since by the bird, you have no interest there, there's no benefit to you that the bird's landing on its back. So therefore, it's considered to be fine. It's not a voda that will be posel the animal. On the other hand, by the zachar, the male mounting the female, in that case, it will be posel, because there you do want that to happen, because then the animals will reproduce. Whether that's because the rancher wants them naturally to reproduce, or he's mating them, and that is what causes the problem. In either instance, you are now have an animal that is pasul because it's carrying the male on its back. It's now done a voda, and it's a voda that you would want, or something that is to your benefit. And so therefore, it's problematic. And similarly, by the case of dash over here, where the animal, you put it into the corral, and it threshes by itself, even though it's threshing, you have no interest in that threshing, because you just wanted it to be in the corral. Again, if you put it in the corral, even if you're putting it to nurse, but you want it to thresh, then what happened was what you wanted to happen. It did work that you intended for. That's enough to be posel it. Tosafot over here asks a very, very fundamental question, which Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach used in his tshuva to extend to other halachic realms, which is Tosafot asks over here, this guy is in ownership now of a para aduma, which is worth huge sums of money. He can sell this para aduma. We know from the stories in Kiddushin that they paid huge premiums for these animals. Meantime, a male mounts the animal, and the male mounting the animal is going to make it into a para aduma psula, and he won't be able to use it anymore. So you tell me, that does he really have a vested interest in these animals mating? He doesn't want them to mate, because if they mate, it's going to be posted as a para aduma. So how can you say here that he likes it or he wants them to mate, and therefore it's a para aduma psula? So Tosafot here extends a principle, which is that if the reason that you don't want it is because of the halachic ramification, that's not considered not wanting it. You have to not want it even in an independent scenario, which means had it not been for the fact that this animal would be psula because the male mounted it, you would have wanted them to mate. Your interest in them mating is there and you would be positive about it, if it were not for the halachic ramifications. And the halachic ramification can't determine your feeling about the incident. We want to know your feelings about the incident independent of the halachic ramification. Tosafot then, based on his own principle, asks what's the difference then between the male mounting the female and the animal threshing. Because also by the animal threshing, you would, in other circumstances, be fine with this animal walking and doing the threshing. How come over here we don't say that is pusela, because the only reason you don't want it to thresh is the halachic ramification. So Tosafot talks about the insignificance of the act of disha, as well as the fact that the other animals will do it, and therefore it's not adding enough value that you would consider it to be an override of the halachic ramifications. But in the case of the mounting, where there is a significance to the mating of the animals, whether, again, that he is actively seeking to mate the animals, or whether that's just, again, a natural form, it's something that he wants to happen and has real value to it, meaning that the animal born of this mating is going to garner him significant amount of money, not as significant as a para aduma, but enough that it is something that he would want in other circumstances. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, based on this, says that the opening of a refrigerator on Shabbat, where the light goes on, that is what we otherwise know as a psik reshe, right? It's something that's going to happen automatically, but you could argue that it is delo nechale, that it's something that he doesn't want. He doesn't want the light to go on when he goes into the refrigerator. He simply wants to gain access to the refrigerator, the things in the refrigerator. If it was up to him, he wouldn't have the light go on because then he can't open it up on Shabbat. So for that reason, you would think maybe it's a psik reshe de lo nechale. And that has its own ramifications, meaning that first of all, even according to those that think or don't paskin that psik reshe de lo nechale is mutar, they only think it's asur mi de rabbanan. So that would obviously have its own ramifications. As well as the fact that if it's only an isur de rabbanan, then a psik reshe de lo nechale, in those instances, the Raman paskins that maybe psik reshe de lo nechale would be okay if it's only an isur de rabbanan. The Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach argues that you can't claim that this is a psik reshe de lo nechale. It's only a psik reshe de lo nechale because of the halachic ramifications. The only reason you don't want the light to go on when you open up the refrigerator is because it's a violation of Shabbat, and then you can't open the refrigerator. Had it been a weekday, you would want the light to go on. That's why you have a light in the fridge, because it goes on during the week, and you're able to see better in the refrigerator. She says the only reason that it is lo nechale is because of the halachic ramification. And based on this Tosafot, here in Baba Metzia, I found in Baba Kama as well, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach claims that you cannot use the halachic ramification as the lo nechale. That can't be the determining factor as to whether you want or don't want a certain action or activity to take place. Like the Tosafot says over here about the animals mating, so too by the opening of the refrigerator, the only reason you don't want the light to come on is so that you can open it on Shabbat, that you don't violate Shabbat. That's not a reason to call it lo nechale. It is nechale. You want the light to come on. It just happens to be in this particular halachic context, you don't want it to come on, and that's not called lo nechale. Again, by association, I would speculate that maybe, with regards to avelut, when it comes to avelut, there is a requirement, if they are an avel, one's parents, that they do not cut their hair, they do not shave their beard, and there is no time frame for that, except, ad shegorim bo chaverav. Those friends tell him he looks unkempt, that he looks like he is a mess. And after that point, then he can cut, or then he can do something about it. Many people today know this halacha, and then they go and tell the individual, right after they cross over the shloshim threshold, they go ahead and say to them, you know, you look terrible, you gotta go get a haircut. Now, the whole reason they're telling that individual is because they know the halacha. They're not being honest about his appearance, they're simply doing it in order to trigger the halachic ramification. So the question is that really considered to be a valid indication of goyin bo chaverav if the impetus for that claim is a halachic impetus and not because they really believe that the person looks unkempt? And so I'm just throwing that out there. It's not exactly like this case, but it has a similar question related to this in a similar manner, which is that if the halachic ramification is what's driving the person's action, is that action considered to be an action? Is that considered to be efficacious in allowing the individual then to cut his hair? Or if it's all driven by the halachic ramification, maybe that action is not a real action, or it's not something that we consider in this case. Again, that would make it very hard because most people know the halacha today. And then when is that threshold when a person is being honest about the person's appearance versus when they're doing it because of the halachic ramification? Klei kesef uklei nechoshet. Silver utensils, copper utensils, mishtamesh bem, you can utilize them. Tana banan, omotze kli eitz, someone who finds wooden utensils, mishtamesh bem, bishvil shelo yekrivu. He can utilize them so that they do not go bad, they do not rot. And that wood will dry out, or it will start to deteriorate if it's not used over a period of time. So you use the wooden utensil in order to protect it, in a sense. Klei nechoshet, mishtamesh ben bechamin. Klei nechoshet, copper utensils you can use with hot water. Avalo ayidea ur, but not in the fire. Mivnei shemashchikan, because that wears them down. So you can utilize them in a way that maintains the integrity of the metal, because if you just leave them buried, which is there for safekeeping, the metal is going to rust or go bad. So we want you to utilize them. What type of utilization is considered to be both okay and not deleterious to the copper? That's if you use it with cold or hot, regular usage. But as soon as you put it into the fire, that's going beyond the necessary usage to maintain the quality of the metal and actually will ruin it. Klei chesef, mishtamesh ben bitzonein, avalo bechamin. If it comes to silver, you can use it with cold, not with hot. B'nei shemashchiran, because it blackens them or causes tarnishing of the silver. When you use them with cold, that just maintains the silver because it prevents the oxidation. But once you put them into hot water or use hot water with them, that doesn't prevent the tarnishing, but actually accelerates the tarnishing. So that we're not going to want. Magrifot vekardumot. If you have magrifa, it's like a pan or a shovel. Vekardumot, again, is a spade or a hatchet. Mishtamesh behen berach. You can use them for soft items. Avalo bekasheh. But not with hard items, b'nei shemafchitin, because that dents them or ruins them. So you can utilize them with items that are not going to cause damage to these items. Klei zav, klei zechuchit, lo yiga behen, similar to our Mishnah, when it comes to gold and glass, don't touch them. Ad shiyavo Eliyahu, till Eliyahu comes, because gold will maintain its integrity even without being used. You can simply put it in the ground and it'll be fine. And glass is just too fragile for you to utilize. And therefore, the value of your keeping it active is way offset by the possibility of damage being done because of the fragility of the glass. All these halachot that we just brought relate to an aveda. That same din applies if someone deposits the object with you to watch. Gemara says, pikadon ma'avidite igabe. When it comes to an object that is deposited with you, what are you using it for? When it's deposited with you, that's exactly what it's for, to be put away and not to be utilized. The aveda has a different aspect to it because of the fact that you found it, and now you're trying to return the object intact. On the other hand, if someone deposits something with you, they know they've deposited with you, and it's up to them to determine when it needs to be utilized or what needs to be done in order to protect it. It's a case when, in a sense, it looks like an aveda. The owners have gone overseas, and they deposit it with you. They rely on you not only to watch it, but also to maintain it, and to ensure that it is properly cared for. And so their pikadon, when they're not around, involves not only a deposit, but also a role in ensuring that it doesn't deteriorate. And that would mean that you'd have to engage in these items, like we just said before, for the aveda, in order to prevent any deterioration of the object. All right, now the Gemara says, "Matzah sak kupa chol davar shein darko lito." The end of the Mishnah says, if he finds items that are beneath his dignity to pick up, arizeh lo yito, you don't pick it up. Why is that the case? Usually, when it comes to the dinei Torah, we say ein etzah utfuna, that there is no consideration in the halacha to your own personal needs. The law or the mitzvah dictate what you have to do. So why all of a sudden over here is there an exception to the rule that says that beneath your dignity, you don't have to perform the mitzvah of Hashemah Taveda. It says the Tanu Banan ve'it alamta, that you look away. Pamim she'ata mitalim, upamim she'i ata mitalim. Sometimes you look away, sometimes you don't look away. It's because of the way that in the Torah, in Parashat Ki Tetzeh, the way that it's phrased, the Hashemah Taveda, it there restricts you from turning away, which is that if you see an aveda and you do not pick it up, but rather you're hitalem, you would look, make as if you didn't see it. You pretend like you don't see it. There you're in violation of the isur to walk away from an aveda. The way that it's phrased there, it says, ve'it alamta, that you will look away. So the Gemara takes from that, that there are times where you are permitted to look away or to walk away from it. Ha'ketzad. Haya kohen v'ibbeit ha'kfarot. If he's a kohen and the aveda is found in the cemetery, oshi has a kohen v'enol fik vodo, or he's a person of age and it's beneath his dignity, oshaytam alacha shalom meruba mishal chaveiro, or his own work exceeds the value of the object itself. He will make more money in the time that he returns the object than the object is worth. L'kach ne'amar, that's why the pasuk says v'italamta mehem. These items are accepted from the mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda. Lamai itzrich kra. Why do you need a pasuk? Meaning that all of these, the Gemara thinks, are obvious even without the pasuk. Ilem al kohen v'hi beit akbarot. If you're done at a kohen and he's in the cemetery, pshita. Hay asay. V'hay lo tasay v'asay. There's an asay of Hashavat Aveda. On the other hand, there's a restriction against the kohen becoming tamei, which involves both a lo tasay, which is, he may not become Tamei, as well as an assay of Kadoshim Yiyu, that they should be Kadosh, meaning that they have to maintain their Kedushat Kehuna, and not make themselves Tamei. And because we know that v'lo ati asei v'dachi et lo tasei v'asei, so now you have an asei of hashavata veda, which in other instances would override the lo tasei of becoming tamei, but that's not true here because not only is there a lo tasei of tumah, there's also an asei to not become tumah, and an asei does not override a lo tasei v'asei. The truth is, by hashavata veda, there's an asei and a lo tasei. But as the Mifashim put out, that doesn't make a difference. Because lo tasei is not the vehicle which overrides other items. It's only an asei that overrides. The only thing that's important to us is the asei of aveda, can it override the lo tasei of tuma? The answer in their end is no, because there's also an asei associated with it. But if that's the case, why would you have a havamina that the kohen should go into the Beit HaKvarot in order to pick up the item? In addition, there's another problem, which is the Gemara in other places tells us that asei dochelot asei only applies when it happens simultaneously, which is when you violate the lot asei, you accomplish the asei. Over here, when he enters into the Beit HaKvarot, he becomes tamei. He's not retrieving the aveda until he reaches it wherever it is inside of the Beit HaKvarot. So the lot asei is violated immediately when he enters into Beit HaKvarot. The asei hashavet aveda only takes place once he gets it into his possession, when he picks it up and then is going to return it. So the asei happens way after the lot asei, so that may not even be able to justify an asei doche lot asei, as well as the fact that we do find in other instances that by a kohen we do allow for asei doche asei velot asei. So that's interesting in terms of the Rishonim discussing over here what is the nature of this asei doche lot asei v'asei. I just note here that Bali et Tosafot in two places in Shas discuss this concept of why an asei is not doche asei v'lot asei. Is it because the asei is doche lot asei? So it works. The asei knocks off the lot asei. But the problem is that the asei still remains. So you have an asei of hashavata veda. It overrides the lot asei of a kohen becoming tamei. So that's done. But now you still have left the asei of tuma, and there's nothing overriding that, and that's still a restriction. Or do we say that the asei doche lot asei v'asei doesn't work is because the asei tells you something about the lot asei? When you simply have a simple lot asei, then you can override the lot asei because that's what it is. It's a simple lot asei, and asei is doche lot asei. The other hand, when you have a lot asei that includes an asei as well, the asei is telling you something about the lot asei. It's actually making it into a stronger lot asei. It tells you this lot asei is not a regular lot asei. It's a lot asei that is with an asei. It's a stronger one, and therefore the asei doesn't have the ability to override it. The nafkamina between those two explanations will be in a case where the person does violate the lot asei, when he violates the restriction. So for instance, in our case, assuming that you can come up with a scenario where the kohen becomes tamei immediately as he does the Shavata Veda, so now he goes in and does it, despite the fact that he's not supposed to do it. Has he violated the lot asei of tuma? Or has he only violated the asei of tuma? If you believe that the asei doche lot asei works, and what's left over is just the asei, then he's only in violation of an asei. On the other hand, if the asei doche lot asei does not work at all in this case, because the asei tells you that this lot asei is much stronger, then he would be in violation not only of an asei of tuma, but also the lot asei of tuma, and actually might result in a possibility of malkot in that case, because the lot asei stays intact. So that'll be the nafkamina between those two explanations. But for either one of those reasons, the asei is not doche lot asei v'asei, and therefore we don't need a pasuk of it alam tamam to tell us that the kohen doesn't go into the Beit HaKvarot. We would have known that anyway. But basically what the Gemara is suggesting is that whether it's because the asei is not doche the asei and lot asei, or whether it's because you can't come up with a scenario of asei doche lot asei, because like we're saying here, there's a timing problem, it still would have been restricted even without v'italam t'mehem. You don't need a pasuk by aveda to teach you that the kohen doesn't go into the Beit HaKvarot. I would have known that even without the pasuk of v'italam t'mehem. Again, you can come up with a scenario where it happens simultaneously. It's just into the Beit HaKvarot, and he can reach over, and as he becomes tamei, he's picking it up. But either way, the necessity of a pasuk here is certainly not for this. V'tu, lo dachin in isura mikame mamona. The second problem is that you're dealing with different types of mitzvot. Hashavat Veda is a monetary requirement. Tumah is an isur. And we're not going to violate an isur in order to have monetary benefit
to another party in terms of a mitzvah. Now, the truth is, it's not as clear-cut as that. Hashem Aveda also involves an isur, which is that v'italam tamayam, you're not allowed to walk away from it. So there's an isur there. But that might relate to what the Ramban says. Ramban says, whenever you have an asay and a lota say, we have that by tztoka, we have it by other mitzvot, what is the primary aspect? Is the primary aspect of the mitzvah the asay? Is the primary aspect of the mitzvah lota say? Then, once you've determined that, whatever the other item is ancillary. It's coming to bolster the primary cause. So here, by Hashavat Aveda, it's clear that the primary mitzvah is Hashavat Aveda. The lotasei of lotuchal italeim is only coming to bolster the fact that you do the mitzvah tasei. So I wouldn't say that Hashavat Aveda is an isur, because that's not the primary purpose of this mitzvah. It's not to not walk away. The primary purpose of the mitzvah is to return the object. And therefore, it really is a monetary din. And the monetary din is then bolstered by a lota say, which says, don't look away, so that you do the mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda. He says the same thing by tztaka. By tztaka, there's a mitzvah to say to give tztaka. There's a mitzvah of lota say, of lo tikpots ad yadcha, that you shouldn't close your hand. Again, the Ramban over there says that's still considered to be a mitzvah to say. The lota say is coming to bolster the fact that you don't withhold giving tztaka, so that you facilitate the ability or the person giving tztaka. By Tumah, it'll be just the opposite. By Tumah, it might be that the primary thing is the lav, which is don't become Tameh. There is a requirement of Kadosh Miyu. Over here, it's questionable, because over there, maybe the whole point is that the coin stays Kadosh. But you could argue that the Lota say is the primary problem, don't become Tameh. The Assay is just to bolster that, to say, stay Kadosh, don't become Tameh. And so therefore, you could see here that the Hashavat Aveda is considered to be Mamon, even though there's a Lota say involved with it. And the issue of the Kohen, even though there are also monetary losses by him coming Tamei, is an issue of Isser, because the Lota Asay is the primary purpose over there, and the Asay is only done to bolster it. And therefore, most of the Rishonim lean to this being the primary reason over here, that Lota Chinin Isserim become a Mamona. That's the primary reason why the Kohen does not go into the Beit HaKvarot. Nothing to do with Asay Docha Lota Asay in the end, but to do with this issue, that there's an Isser in Mamon, and Isser does not get trumped by a monetary issue or a monetary reason. All right. Now the Gemara says, Ella, what's the point of having this pasuk of italamta that you're allowed to walk away? L'shalom miruba mishal chaveiro, where his work is worth more than the value of his friends. Gemara says that we already learn out mid Rav Yehuda Marav nafka. That we learn out from this memra from Rav. Rav Yehuda Marav eves ki lo yeh b'chayev yon, since there will not be poor people amongst you. And from the word becha, which seemed to focus on the individual himself who's lending the money and forgiving the loan in Shmitat Ksafim, what does the becha teach you that you won't be an evyon? And from here we learn, shelcha kodem l'shel kol adam, that your interests or your monetary interests take precedence over everyone else. Now, the way that Rashi explains it over here is what he means is that you shouldn't make yourself poor supporting the aniyim. You can't give tztaka into the mitzvah of tztaka and impoverish yourself by doing the mitzvah. But that has broader implications, which means that when there are competing interests, for instance, your ability to make more money here versus return this person's aveda, which is worth less than the money that you're going to make, then your interests should take precedence over here, because there's no reason for you to give up monetary gain for the monetary benefit of another party. It's a question of who's going to benefit monetarily, you or the other person. So you come first whenever that is the question. That's the same question over here. If your value in working exceeds the value of the Aveda, there's no reason for you to stop. If that's the case, I don't need Bitalamta to teach me that. That's already a din that I know from the issues of Tztaka. Rashi says that the question over here relates to the Aveda itself. Shivatel bahashbata mruba al demei aveda. He says that your loss of wages exceeds the value of the aveda. You could argue, which the Gemara is going to say in a second, is that you do get reimbursed. When you do work and you pick up the aveda, the person who you did that for has to pay you like a poel batel. Like a worker who is doing nothing and he gets some work. Is he worth giving up his vacation to work? Right? How much money would he accept in order to give up his vacation to work? Or From another perspective, how much is he willing to take a discount on his salary to do easy work, like Hashavat Aveda versus the hard labor or whatever other work it would be to get the higher salary? So therefore, you could argue that the differential here is not about necessarily the value of the Aveda, but the value of your wages versus the wages you're going to gain from doing this or returning this Aveda. So the discounted wages, is there a value that you're willing to accept as a discount in order to do the mitzvah as well as to do quote-unquote lighter work? Are you willing to accept it? So that wouldn't focus on the value of the Aveda, but rather on the value of the wages that you would gain by doing your own work versus doing this Hashavat Aveda. You could, instead of phrasing like Rashi of focusing on the Aveda, focus that way. Or you could say that what Rashi means is that whenever your wages do not exceed the value of the Aveda, then we say that the mitzvah is worth something. Yes, you have to give up some money sometimes. You have to lose some value in order to return the Aveda, to do a mitzvah. We're not going to go as far as to say that take a loss, quote unquote, on this, which means lose more wages than the Aveda is worth. But if it's worth less than the Aveda, you will have to accept some loss in order to perform the mitzvah. You could argue that that's what Rashi is saying. And maybe that's if you would make $50 and the Aveda is worth $60, the incremental gain is only $10. From your perspective, the $50 is much, much more. It's not worth it for you. So you might be able to walk away like that because of the Dmei Bitul, which we said is, according to others, which is the value of your salary exceeds what you're going to make here, and the differential is just not worth it to you. Or you could argue that at certain points, the mitzvah dictates that you have to give up something in order to do the mitzvah. All right, so now, Amar says, Elo lezakein v'eino lifi kvodo. In the bottom line, what do you need hitalamta for? It's to teach you that if the person is of a certain stature or age, and it's beneath his dignity to pick it up, then he doesn't have to pick it up. And that's what hitalamta teaches you. The Baal Tosafot say that we also know, because we know from other places in Shas that kavod habriyot is doche lo taseh shebat Torah. That when it comes to kavod habriyot, we have it by kilayim, and we also have it by meit mitzvah. By both of those cases, kavod habriyot dictates that we override what otherwise would be a lo taseh. Tosfot says, how come we don't extrapolate that to over here? This is kavod habriyot. Zakein v'ein lefi kvodo. Tosfot then says that those examples of kavod habriyot, where it overrides, are unique examples. There are examples where it involves either a meit mitzvah, which is a body that is laying there and is not going to get buried and then is going to deteriorate, it's going to decompose, which is a serious lack of kavod habriyot. It's on a different plane than normal kavod habriyot, as well as where the Gemara brings it in Brachot and Nidah and other places with regards to kilayim, that a person had he not actively worn kilayim but was passively wearing kilayim, and he would have to strip down in the middle of the shuk, we see over there that kavod habriyot would override. So again there, being naked is such an embarrassment or such a indignity to this individual that kavod habriyot is on a different plane. It's what Tosfot does now, is takes this concept of kavod habriyot being doche and raises the threshold by which it has to be kavod habriyot. It's not all kavod habriyot is doche. It's only kavod habriyot when it's significant or serious, like the decomposition of a body, or when a person is going to be left naked in the shuk, those are significant enough that kavod habriyot would be doche. But over here, where the kavod habriyot is simply, it's a little bit indignified for him to pick up something, or it's beneath his dignity to pick it up, that we're not going to say unless you have a pasuk that indicates vitalamta that you're allowed to walk away from the aveda. Amar Abba, hikisha chayav ba. If he hits the animal, when he is a zakim v'ein lefi kvodo, so he's not going to engage in it, so he starts to hit the animal to drive it towards its owner. Then the Gemara says, Rabba says, you're engaged, now you have to deal with it. Which is interesting, because the Baal HaTosafot argued against this. Back on Chav Hei Amud Bet, the Baal HaTosafot say over there, that zakim v'ein lefi kvodo, even if you pick it up, you can put it back down. Because you are not connected to the Aveda. The Torah says you're not chayav to pick up the Aveda. Therefore, even if you pick it up, you do not become engaged with the Aveda. If it was something that you wouldn't have otherwise picked up, something that you wouldn't have done, you could just put it back down and you're not responsible for it. Yet over here, what it's saying is, if you hit the animal, then you are engaged and now you have to deal with the Aveda. So that seems to be soter, undermine what Tosfot said back on Chav Hei Amud Bet. Tosfot over there says that this is a unique case and is only applicable to animals, not to any other Aveda. So Rabba's din is not a din that if you engage in the Aveda, then you have to now deal with it. That's what it would sound like. Bepashtut is that once you engage with the animal, you're now responsible for it. So that means any aveda, even though you have a right to walk away, once you don't walk away and you engage in the aveda, you become chayav. That would be the simplest reading. Tosafot says no, that this is an exceptional rule by behemot, because once you whack it, it becomes used to being out and running away. And since you've now given it the freedom to run away or go away, you have to now be responsible to bring it back in. So not only have you done something or engaged with the aveda, but you've actually done something to the detriment of the aveda, and now you need to rectify that and bring it back to its owner, so that the owner knows about it and knows that you've pushed it in a direction. So Tosafot says this is unique to behema, and therefore when you engage with the behema, you've done something to its detriment, now you got to fix the problem and get it back to its rightful owner. On the other hand, by other avedot, even if he picks it up, he can just put it back down because he's not chayav and he doesn't have any connection to aveda. He's not engaged in the mitzvah of aveda because the Torah says you're exempt. Other hand, you could read this, not like the Baalei Tosafot, and say this is a broader din with regards to aveda, and say that any aveda where you engaged, even though you have a right to walk away, once you don't walk away and you engage with it, then you become responsible to deal with the aveda, and your patur exemption is no longer there. Baalei Yotiv Kamei D'Rabba, Baalei, who is the Talmud of Rabba, sitting before Rabba, Chazal Anachizei D'Kaimei, he saw that there were these goats that were hanging around. Obviously, they seemed to be lost based on the story, and they needed to be returned to their owners, but Abaye just wanted to get rid of them and push them away so they wouldn't eat in this field. It wouldn't be over here. Shakal Kala Vishadabai. He took a clod of dirt and threw it at them. Amalei. So now Rabba says to Abaye, Ichayav Tebehu. Kum Adrinu. That's exactly what I said about Hikisha. You did the equivalent thing. You drove the animals. Okay, so you didn't use a stick and drive them, but you used the dirt to drive the animals. By doing so, you became engaged, and now you're responsible to return the animals. And now the Gemara moves on to a new question. Ibailu. It is not beneath his dignity to return something in the field, but it is beneath his dignity to return something in the city. The obvious reason is because people will see him in the city, they won't see him in the field. So in the field, he feels comfortable doing it, in the city, he feels uncomfortable doing it. So Mahu, what is the din here? Now, the way Rashi phrases it is, if he finds it in the field and has to bring it to the city, what is the din? And since he's starting in a location where it's not beneath his dignity, then he has to then bring it to the city where it is beneath his dignity. Does the starting point matter and therefore override the end point? Or do we say no, because the end point is going to be problematic, therefore the start point is problematic. That's the way Rashi phrases it. You could see the question more abstractly, which is, the fact that you are chayav in one location, does that impact your chiyuv in the other location? Meaning the fact that in some scenario you are chayav, does that mean then that you're chayav in all locations? Or the other way around, the fact that you're patur in one location, does that make you patur in all locations? So you could ask the question abstractly rather than the way Rashi does, which is that it is a practical question, which is once you picked it up in the sadeh, what's your obligation in terms of bringing it into the city? So ma'o, mi amrinen ashava ma'alya bi'inan. You have to return it properly. Became the lav darkei lachzir be'ir. Since he normally wouldn't do this in the city, lo lechayiv. He's not chayav to engage with it in the field. Odilma b'sadeh miyat hu dechayiv le. Since he's obligated in the field, became the chayiv le b'sadeh, chayiv le be'ir. Since you're already chayav in the sadeh, that makes you obligated in the city as well. Since at the point of engagement you were chayav, it persists even when you go back into the city, and you would have to return it in the city. Teiku, the Gemara leaves this as an unresolved issue. Again, whether the question is when you find it in the field, do you have to then pick it up because you're chayav there, and then deal with it into the city? Migo, that you're chayav in the city, in the field, you're chayav in the city. Or do we say the other way around? Since you can't complete the action in the city, therefore you're now patur in the field, even if it was all self-contained in the field, you'd be chayav. Or you can ask the question more abstractly. Does the fact that you're chayav in the field then impact your chiyuv in the city? And say that the chiyuv in the field makes it that you should also be chayav in the city, because if it's not beneath your dignity there, then it shouldn't be beneath the dignity here. Or the other way around, since it's beneath your dignity in the city, that affects your ability to do it in the field as well. The Gemara leaves that as unresolved. Amar Rava, kol bishalo machzir, bishal chavero nami machzir. Anything that you would do for yourself, you do for your friend. Basically, if something of yours fell or was lost, then you would go and pick it up or deal with it. Then you also have to do that for your friend. If it's not beneath your dignity to do it for yourself, it's not beneath your dignity to do for someone else, and vice versa. If it is beneath your dignity to do it for yourself, then you're not obligated to do it for your friend. Anything that you would do for your own loads, meaning that whether it's to unload the animal or load the animal up, so too by your friend's items, you'd have the same obligation. So this test, or the litmus test as to whether it's beneath your dignity or not, has to do with if it's your own items. If you would engage in your own items in that manner, then you're chayav to engage with your friend's item. If you wouldn't do this for your own items, then you don't have to do it for your friend's items. That is the litmus test as to whether it's beneath your dignity or not. So Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi, Avakazil Ba'orcha, who was going along the way, Pagabei Hau Gavra, bumped into this individual, Avadori Patcho Dofi, he was carrying a load of wood on his back, Odvinu, Bekamitbach, he put them down, he sat down, and he was resting. Amalei, so then he says, it turns to Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi and says, Dolili, load me back up. He's ready to get up now, and he needs to go on his way, but he can't load the wood onto his back by himself. And if someone else helps him, he can carry it, he can be sochev, he can take the heavy load. But he himself can't raise the load from the ground onto his back properly. So he wants Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi to help him out with it. Amalei, kama shavin. He says, how much is this wood worth? Amalei, palga de zuza. It's worth half a zuz, this load of wood. Yaivlei, palga de zuza. Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi hands him a palga de zuza. Basically, he buys the wood off of him. The afkara, and then he was mafkirit, thus what says to avoid people violating lo tigzol, because Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi wasn't going to pick it up, it was beneath his dignity, just like it was beneath his dignity to reload this guy, so he pays for it, but then he's mafkirit. Hadar zachabo, the guy who was carrying the wood, after Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi is mafkir them, he repossesses them. Hadar yayiv lei paga dezuza, and he does the same thing, he asks Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi to load him up again. And so Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi has to buy it off of him again, and pays him another half zuz. The afkara, and once again he was mafkirit. Chazia dava kaboy the mihader the miskebuhu. Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi saw that this guy was going to do the same thing again, which was he's going to repossess them, and he's going to force Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi to buy it off of him again. Amalei the kuli alma afkarinu, but the chalo afkarinu. I was mafkirit for everybody else in the world besides you. You have no right to take it. Gemara says, me avyefkiki I gavno. Does that really it result in hefker in disowning of an item? But it's not. Don't we have a Mishnah in Pe'ah as well as a Mishnah in Idiot that says, "Vichemayo meim efker le'aniim efker." If you're mafkir something only for poor people, that is considered to be hefker. Beitilelo meim enu efker at sheyefker le'aniim uliyashirim kishmita. It's only deemed to be hefker or ownerless when you're mafkir, when you disown it both to the anim and ashirim, meaning to everybody, just like by shmita, where the fields are open to anybody who wants to go into them. The Mishnah over here is speaking about whether you're chayav in masrot or not. Which hefker is poter you from masrot? Beit Shammai says, well, if you're mafkir the aniim, that already is poter you from masrot, because that's considered to be hefker. Beit Hillel says, that's not hefker. Hefker is when you disown it completely. That means that it's open to anyone else to take it. If you're still controlling the recipient of the item, even though you quote-unquote have disowned it, that means that you're still exerting control in determining who is the recipient of this item. What hefker means is that you've disowned it completely. You have no control or residual control on the item. And that's only true when you're mafkir to whoever comes and picks it up. Over here, when Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi is mafkir to everyone besides him, that is not hefker according to Beit Hillel. Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi l'kulei ama afkarinu. Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi really was mafkir to everyone. Ubemilta ba'alma hu d'ukme. And he just told the guy that he did it this way in order to prevent them from creating this problem over and over again, which is every time that Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi is mafkirit, the guy picks it up and forces Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi to pay money and to buy it off of him. And so he, in a sense, fabricated the nature of the hefker over here in order to prevent the recurrence of this problem. But in his heart, he was really mafkirit legamre. Tosafot over here says, how could Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi be mafkir? Hefker requires three people to be present in order to be mafkir an item. That's an assumption of the Balei Tosafot. Not all Rishonim agree. The Gemara seems to indicate you need to be done in front of three. There are other Rishonim that differentiate in the type of hefker, whether you need the three people or don't need the three people there in order to generate the hefker. But Tosafot, assuming that you do need three people there to be mafkir, how was Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi mafkir here if there weren't three people? So Tosafot says maybe there were three people there, and it was hefker because there were three people there. Or the Balei Tosafot suggests over here that d'oraita min a Torah, maybe you do not require three. That maybe that's an institution derabbanan that you require three people to be there for hefker. But min haTorah, as soon as you articulate that you're disowning it, that's considered to be hefker. The Tosafot then brings a third possibility, which is that in certain cases of hefker, we are anan sadeh. We know that the person wants to be mafkir because he's being mafkirid in order to avoid any sur. And he brings this with the garbe items on Shabbat and Shvitat Kelim, that the person's mafkir, they mean though there are not three people there, anan sadeh, he wants to rid himself of the ownership in order not to violate the isurim. So therefore, Tosafot gives three possibilities of how he's mafkirid here, which is either there were three people here, midoraita, you don't need three people, or, and the third item, hefker, is where anan sadeh, we know he wants to be mafkirit in order not to violate an isur. What's interesting is the Balei Tosafot in Psachim believe that bitul works mishum hefker. That bitul, the ability to be mevatel chametz, believe, is really functioning because of hefker. You're disowning the item. Tosafot over there runs into a problem, which is, if it's hefker, don't you need three people to be mafkir the whole? So the answer is, maybe you do need three people going to the Balei Tosafot. Number two possibility is, the fact that midoraita, you don't need three people. Or, you could argue now, what Tosafot added over here is that, we know the reason you want to be mafkir the chametz is to avoid the Isur chametz. So anan sadeh, that the guy really wants to be mafkir the item. It might be that the three people are just an indication of gemirat halev, that the guy's serious about disowning it. But maybe there are other exogenous variables that could indicate his seriousness here, which is the fact that the Isur chametz is coming and he wants to be mevatel it, that is an indication of his seriousness of disowning it, because otherwise this would be in violation of the Isur of chametz. So even though Tosafot himself does not mention that as a possibility over there, based on what Tosafot's saying here, you could answer the question that Tosafot raises in Psachim with regards to Bitul, that if Bitul's working Mishum Hefker, where are the three people? It may be that it's Anan Sadeh, that we know he wants to get rid of the chametz because he wants to avoid the Isur, or like Tosafot says over here, maybe that's only a din derabonon, but din doraita is that you can be mafkir and bittul works min haTorah. Now the Gemara asks, Rabbi Yishmael Rabbi Yosef zakein veino lefi kvodo avo. The reason that Rabbi Yishmael Rabbi Yosef was paying this guy off was because it was beneath his dignity to load him up. But that means he wouldn't have loaded himself up. He wouldn't do this for his own items. That means he's not obligated to do it for this individual. Why is he paying him off to avoid doing this when he is exempt completely from having to do this mitzvah? My answer is Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi lifnim mishurat hadin hu da'avad. He was doing this not by the letter of the law, but by the spirit of the law. He knows that the Torah wants us to do this. Even though he is personally exempt, he didn't want to take that exemption, and therefore he paid the guy off. The Tani Rabbi Yosef, so this we had in the Gemara in Baba Kama, on Sadi Ted Amud Bet, and Kuf Amud Aleph, where the Gemara also there spoke about the issue of lifnim mishurat hadin, there about Rabbi Chia, and we'll explain the parallels between them. Vodata lehem, you will tell them about these mitzvot. Ze beit chayehem. What does that mean, vodata lehem? Here it's Yitro telling Moshe what Moshe's job is going to be. So one of the things his job is going to be, vodata lehem, you're going to make known to them. Zu beit chayehem. Rashi over here, it says, beit chayehem, limod lehem umanut, leit pranespo. You're going to teach them trades and ability to make a living. Rashi back in Baba Kama says that it is Torah. You're going to make them into Talmidei Chachamim. You're going to teach them the Torah. It's interesting. In Baba Kama, Rashi says it's teaching Torah. Over here, he says that it's teaching them a craft or an ability to make a parnosa. Maybe it's both. Beit Chayim is the ability for them to live, to give them the ability to make a living. But make a living involves two aspects to it. It involves both parnosa and Torah. And maybe they're not mutually exclusive. Maybe they're both necessary in order for a person to have chayim, to have life. Et derech, you're going to teach them the way. Zog milut chasadim. That is that you have to do gmilat chesed. Yelchu, that they will, the path that they will take. Ze bikur cholim, that's going to do or visit the sick. Ba, zog kfura, the way that they will go. Ba, that teaches you kfura. Bet ha-maseh, and the activities or the actions that they should take, Zadin, that's the letter of the law. Asher Yasun, Zolifni Mishurat Adin, that they will do is even the spirit of the law. Meaning that one should not conduct themselves by the letter of the law, but rather by the spirit of the law. And they bring a proof from the Pasuk here that says Asher Yasun, tells you that there is some sort of obligation to do Lifni Mishurat Adin. This goes back to the Balei HaTosafot, back on Chav Dalet Amud Bet, where the Balei HaTosafot say that there are different types of lifnim mishurat hadin. One of the types of lifnim mishurat hadin that Tosafot notes over there is based on the Gemara in Baba Kama, but it's true here as well, is that the individual is exempt, but everybody else is chayav. Everybody else who came upon this circumstance would be obligated to deal with it. This particular individual has an exemption. That's the case over here. Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi is patur because they came in ufi kvodo. It's beneath his dignity. Anybody else who came here and it wasn't beneath their dignity would have to do it. So he has a particular exemption where everybody else is chayav. Similar to the case in Baba Kama, Rabbi Chia, when he was looking at coins, and he told the woman it was a good coin, and it turned out not to be a good coin, anybody else in that circumstance would have to pay and make whole this woman that they gave bad advice to. Then Rabbi Chia, as an expert, was indemnified, and he would not have to pay because he was an expert. Yet, Rabbi Chia did it, lifnei mishur hadin. Why? Because anybody else would be chayav. Rabbi Chia, even though he had an exemption, didn't want that. Tosfot says, that's, you need the pasuk of Asher Yasun to teach you, that the lifnei mishur hadin, which is where everybody else is chayav, and you are exempt, that you should look at not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law, and there's an obligation to go lifnei mishur hadin. And that's what Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi does over here, that's what Rabbi Chia does over there, and that's why they quote a pasuk Asher Yasun. That's what Tosfot says, that's one type of lifnei mishur hadin. The other two types of lifnei mishur hadin, one we bumped into on Chav Dalet Amud Bet, which is where everybody is exempt, yet you still do it, but there's no monetary loss to you. And then there is a third type, which is that lifnei mishur hadin, even when it costs you money to do lifnei mishur hadin, that comes from a pasuk that we quote from Mishlei, l'man yelchu b'derech tovim. You should do the good thing, you should do the right thing. So this is one of those types of lifnei mishur hadin. Then the Gemara here in Baba Kama ends. We noted when the Gemara ended in Baba Kama that there's a problem in this Braita that Rav Yosef is quoting, which is, the Braita says that these different aspects which Moshe is being told by Yitro, he should instruct the people about. Again, Beit Chayim, we noted the difference in Rashi in those two cases. But then it says that you have to do Gemilat Chesed. But then it brings down Bikur Cholim and Kvura, both of which are subcategories of Gemilat Chesed. The Gemara in Baba Kama doesn't ask, but the Gemara here asks this and says, "Amar Mar, Yelchu Zei Bikur Cholim, Hainu Gemilut Chesedim." That's Gemilut Chesed. Why is that covered by Gemilut Chesed? Lo Nitzrocha LaBen Gilol. That is because based on the Gemara in Nidarim that says that Amar Mar Ben Gilol No Telachad Mishishim B'Chol Yom. When an individual visits the sick, is the Ben Gilol of the person who is sick. Not only does he benefit the person who is sick, he also takes 1/60th of the sickness of the individual. So there, it's not so straightforward that when you go and visit, you're doing something to benefit the sick person. You're also acquiring a part of the sickness. You're actually weakening yourself. So, there's still an obligation to go visit the sick, despite the fact that you might become slightly affected by this sickness because of this view of the Gemara Nidarim, if you're Ben Gilo, that you acquire 1/60th of the sickness. Rashi, we just saw before in the Gemara here, translated Ben Gilo as being someone born under the same mazel. Again, we noted in Nidarim that there are those that say it means someone of the same age. You could argue that it's both, meaning that it's Ben Gilo, means if someone's the exact same age, and they're born under the same mazel. You could combine the two explanations. But because of that risk, you would think maybe you wouldn't be obligated to the Gemilat Chesed. The answer in the end is yes. You do the Gemilat Chesed anyway. Now, I don't think this indicates that if there is some sort of contagious disease and you do Bikur Cholim, that you have to put yourself at risk for this contagious disease. You have to take proper precautions. These are things that are what we call beyond the natural means, but rather things that are in the other realms. Like we saw before in the Gemara, that your money takes precedence, so does your health takes precedence over the other person's health. But here, what this tells you is that even sometimes when there is some detrimental aspect to you in doing the mitzvah, this gemilut chesed might still apply, assuming that it's reasonable. Then you would still have this obligation to do bikur cholim. Ba zo kvura. We said before that ba means burying of the dead. Ayu gemilut chesed. Again, that's gemilut chesedim. Lo nitzrocha el zakein ve'ino lifi kvodo. That's what Tosva noted before, that even though it's beneath the dignity of the individual, mitzvah takes precedence. Kvura takes precedence because of the fact that there is a problem with kavod abriyot, and therefore, even though it's beneath your dignity, the dignity of the mate far exceeds your dignity now, and we're going to compel you to deal with the mate, even though other instances you would be able to walk away. It is a subset of gemilut chesed, but it's a subset of gemilut chesed that has special rules, which is that even though other aspects of Gemilat Chesed you would not be obligated to do if it was beneath your dignity, here you're obligated to do it even if it's below your dignity. Asher yasun zu lifnei mishuat adin. This is something that means not the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. Damar Rabbi Yochanan lo charva Yerushalayim ala shedanu badin Torah. The reason that Yerushalayim was destroyed is because they followed the Torah law. Where it says, Ela dine de megizda ledainu? Wait a minute. What do you want them to do? You want them to do these strong arm tactics? This is actually a Gemara that we had at the end of Baba Kama, Adaf Kujudalad Amud Aleph. There the Gemara talks about the Persian law system that they are dine de megizda, that they are strong armed dayanim, which meant different things according to the Rishonim, but many Rishonim said that they, first of all, ensure that if they give a psak halacha, they don't just say, do it. They enforce it through corporal punishment, or they enforce their psak. But dinat megizda means like these strong arm tactics. So Gemara is asking, what do you want them to do? They were following the din Torah. What do you want them to do? Do a din like the Persian law, or like they, people use these strong arm tactics? Of course they were doing din Torah. Ella, Ema, amended to say this, Shemidu dinayim al din Torah, that they followed the letter of the law, v'lo abdul ifni mishur tadin, but they did not look at the spirit of the law. This is something that's lost all the time in terms of din Torah. You have to take into consideration not only the legal letter of the law, but the equitable outcome in situations, and understand what it means that, yes, there's a din Torah and there's a letter of the law, but there are also ramifications of the letter of the law. And the spirit of the law sometimes would dictate otherwise or suggest that we act differently. Even though you're entitled to something, or even though you're entitled to do something, the ramifications of that are so deleterious that we'd rather you follow the spirit of the law. And that acting lifnei mishurat hadin is something that is an ideal that we look for, and we don't just say, follow the letter of the law. The Baal Yom Tov Sofot over asks over here, wait a minute, don't we have the Gemara in Yoma that says that the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of the three cardinal sins? The second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. Over here it's saying it's because they kept the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law. Tosfot answers, Hava'al Gamerle, that they are both causations, that these are multiple causes for the Churban HaBayit. I wanted to suggest maybe there's a common denominator between them, but they stem from the same root problem, which is a lack of consideration for others, which is that doing something at the letter of the law, not the spirit of the law, is that you don't care about the other person. You want to get whatever you're entitled to, and you don't consider the bigger picture or the other people involved. Sinat Chinam also has that aspect to it, which is Sinat Chinam says, somebody wronged me, and therefore I'm entitled to do to them all these things. Now, again, it's not baseless hatred in the sense that you just hate them because you want to hate them. That's also problematic. But that seems too simple. Sinat Chinam, I think that the best definition for it is not baseless hatred, but disproportionate hatred, which is that your response is not in measure to what the wrong that was done to you. You accelerated, you enlarged the problem. And that's what causes that Sinat Chinam, because as Tosfot mentions in the end of the Arvei Psachim, he says that, and we saw this in the Gemara and Yevamot as well, that these types of behaviors are reflective in nature. So once you start hating them, they're going to hate you back, and there's this spiraling condition of increased hatred, but it all stemmed from a very small infraction. And so the idea of this sinat chinam is that it's becoming disproportionate because of the reflective nature of hatred and the back and forth between human beings. And therefore there's an imbalance between your reaction and the way that they acted. But again, it's a lack of consideration for the other person. It's really about me and all the focus on me. And that's really what the failure is in the second Beit HaMikdash, which is that everybody was focused on their own spiritual development and their own selfish gains, and they didn't look outside of their own Dalet Amot. And that leads to not acting lifnei mishurat hadin, and also leads to Sinat Chinam. So I think that you could possibly argue that the root cause of both of these problems is similar in nature, which is too much focus on the self and too little consideration of others. Gemara Mishnah now says, Ezu hi aveda. What is considered to be an aveda? Matzacha moro para roin baderech. He sees a donkey or a cow that is walking around, grazing along the way. Ainzo aveda. That's not an aveda. Their owners might have left them there to graze. That's not an aveda. Chamor v'kelav hafuchim. If you see a donkey and it's load or its saddle or upside down on it, para ratzah ben akramim, or you see a cow running through the vineyards, harizo aveda. That's an aveda. It's clear that the context in which it's found is problematic, whether it's because of the way it looks or because of where it is found. Both of those make it clear that it's an aveda. Hechziro barcha, hechziro barcha. He returns and it runs away again. He returns and runs away again. Afilo arba'a v'chamisha pi'amim. Even if it happens 4 or 5 times, chayav lachzira, you still have an obligation to return it. Shneamar, hashev tishivim. The duplicate lashon means return it over and over again. Hayav batel misela, lo yomar lo tein li sela. If he would have earned a sela in the time period that he goes and returns the aveda, he can't argue to the person who he returned the aveda to pay me my lost wages. Elo no tein lo scharo kipoel. He pays him like a idle worker, meaning an idle worker who's taking on work that is not strenuous in any way, is a lighter form of work. What would he pay for that individual? Yesham beitin, if there is a beitin that's there, put this before, maneh b'fnei beitin, he makes a condition for the beitin, which is, if I pick this up, I'm expecting to get my wages back. Now the beitin obviously will have to make a decision at that point, as to whether it's worth it. I mean, is it worth it to allow this guy to go ahead and return the aveda and lose the wages and have the bal aveda pay him for that? Because the aveda is worth so much more. Or do we say that it's not worth it anymore and tell him, no, don't go, because you can't do it under this condition. But what the Mishnah suggests is that you can make that condition of the return that you get your lost wages as long as you've proffered it before Beit Din and they've approved it. Amen, Shem Beit Din. If there's no Beit Din there, then Shalom Kodem, there he can't do it. Therefore, he has to make a decision that his lost wages are far in excess of the value that's being created over here. And therefore, he can walk away from the Aveda because he's going to lose more money than it's worth, and that he's not obligated to do. He's not obligated to lose his money to benefit another party's monetary standing. Where it says, Atu Kohani Darmin and Lava Aveda Avo, the Mishnah also says, this is an Aveda. As if all the Mishnayot until now were not speaking about avedot. I mean, what's so unique about these items? So Yehuda Achikamar Izui Kalal Aveda Shu Chayav Ba. He's saying, what is the paradigm of when something is obviously an aveda and something's not obviously an aveda? It's giving you principles, but it's not telling you that this in particular is an aveda. It's showing you in this context, understand this scenario in order to determine whether it's an aveda or not. Matzah chamor pararuim baderech ein zo aveda. V'lo mechayev ba, and therefore you're not obligated to deal with them. Chamor v'kelav avuchim parav ratza ben akurim, ar zo aveda u mechayev ba. My says, u'leolam. Is that forever? I mean, if the animals are out on the street day after day after day, do you say then, oh yeah, they're not lost. The owner's sending them every day. No, that seems unreasonable. I mean, there's a reasonable amount of time where animals are left without supervision, as well as without going back home. But if they're there day after day, they're not going anywhere. That doesn't sound like they are being let loose by their owners, but rather it sounds like they are in a veda. Has to be for 3 days. I mean, until 3 days, you assume that this is just their normal course. After 3 days, you already assume they're in a veda. Echidami, what's the scenario? Il bele luta, if it's at night, afilu chadashata nami. Even if they're there for a short period of time, animals at night go back to their farms, their ranches, their corrals. If they're out on the street or they're out grazing at night, it's clear that they're in the wrong place and you need to return them immediately. Ibi yomama, if it's during the day, afilu tuva nami. Lo. If it's during the day, then even more days. Every day, the owner's bringing them out there and he's taking them back in. So just the fact that they're found there during the day should not be indicative of the fact that they're in aveda after 3 days. They could be there forever. It's a case where he sees them early in the morning before dawn, and he sees them at night after it's already gotten dark. If it happens for 3 days, we say, oh, it just happens to be that day the owner got up early, the owner went back late, and so therefore he's letting the animals out early in the morning, he's taking them back in when it's late at night. If you pass 3 days already, nobody gets up that early and goes back that late, day after day after day, and therefore that's already an indication of aveda. Again, the animals are supposed to return to their local place every day. So again, if it happens over a couple of days, you can say the farmer forgot about them, he didn't have time to bring them back in. But if it happens over a longer duration than 3 days, that's very indicative of the fact that they are avedot. Tanya Nami Yochim, a braita that supports that understanding. Matzah Talit Vikardom, he finds a beged, some sort of clothing, or ex hashit basratia. Rashi says, derech chufusha the rabim, which is a main thoroughfare that is heavily trafficked by the rabim. Might be similar to the word that we saw before, astratia, which is like a strata, or an intercity highway. Upara ratza ben akramim, hare zo aveda. Or if you see a cow running through the vineyards, that's an aveda. It's Rashi notes that the cow running through the vineyards is both hurting itself. Rashi says over here, the mistakva. The Gemara later on is going to call it maskva, which is that it wounds or injures itself, as well as it damages the vineyard itself. It's clearly not the location where the animal should be. So, talit bitzad geder. On the other hand, if you find a piece of clothing next to a fence, or kardom bitzad geder, or you find the axe of the hatchet by a fence, upara roa ben akramim, or you see a cow just leisurely grazing between the vineyards, einzo aveda. That is not considered to be an aveda. The gra changes it from kramim to asavim, which would make more sense. Because anytime it's in the vineyard, you have a problem, because the cow just doesn't belong in the vineyard. So the gra changes the girsa and says that the Rambam's girsa here is ben asavim, which is that it is between the grasses. I mean, if it's just grazing out in the grasses, that's a normal grazing for the animal. So that's not considered to be an aveda. Tosafot, back on Chaf Hei Amud Bet, talks about that when the object is by the geder, you have to know whether, first of all, it has a siman or doesn't have a siman. Whether it's shamur or not shamur, is that a place that is safe or where the objects will remain intact without being stolen or ruined? And you need to know whether makom is a siman or not. So all of those were discussed back in Chaf Hei Amud Bet as to when or when you should leave it there by the geder and when you should pick it up. But assuming that it qualifies for all those items, then you would leave it there because if somebody put it there intentionally and didn't leave it there or didn't lose it there, and by your taking it, you're going to cause problems. But if you see the item there 3 days in a row, then it becomes an aveda. So we see this idea of the three-day threshold. He sees as this big flood approaching this friend's field. You have an obligation to put up a fence or sandbags to block the water because Amarova l'chol avedat achicha l'rabot avedat karka. That when it says l'chol avedat achicha means any loss. Any loss includes land losses that he's going to have, not just metaltalim, not just objects that are lost, but losses that will affect his real property. Amalei Rav Chananya l'rova tanya de meseyalach. I have a brayta that supports your position. He sees water approaching. He has to put up a fence. He has to try to block the water from flooding his friend's possessions. And wait, Rova responds to him and says, if that's your proof, it won't really help me. I can explain that case in a case or a circumstance that will not help me. That there are piles of grain on the field. So the reason he has to stop the water is not because of the field itself, but because of the items that are on the field. Idiko omrim, my the memra. Of course, if there are omrim there, he has to do that, because that's classic Hashavat Aveda, which is you're returning metaltalin. Lo tzricha diitbo omrim de tzricha d'ara. There are these piles here, but they need the land upon which they are sitting. And therefore you would have thought, ma'u de tema came de tzricha d'ara ki gufu d'ara damien. Since they need the land, these stalks of growing items or stacks of items that need the ground should be considered like the ground, and you wouldn't have to do a Shavat Aveda, Kamash Malan, that they're considered like metaltalim, and you have to protect them and you have to take care of them. So these stalks or this grain, since it still needs the ground, you would have thought that that's not metaltalim enough to be under the rubric of a Shavat Aveda. The Kamash Malan is it is under that rubric. But that wouldn't teach you anything about the karka itself, the ground itself, which is Rova's Chiddush. Rova's Chiddush is that Hashavat Aveda doesn't just apply to metaltalim or items that are going to be physically moved or lost, but even to property that is fixed in place, if there are going to be losses because of flooding or other items, that there is a requirement to protect or help this individual to do Hashavat Aveda, which is to give him back his land. And we know that that Hashavat Aveda, just like it applies by monetary issues, it also applies by a person's health or by the individual's life, that there's this concept of Hashavat Aveda as well, that if you have to return his possessions, you also have to return or protect his life. And similarly, Rova over here suggests that that applies to his karka, to his real possessions as well. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph.